Computer, identify malfunction immediately.
Pawn to bishop 4. Knight to king's rook 3. Bishop to queen's bishop 4. Knight to knight 5. Queen's knight to king 2.
Controls are not responding, sir.
Queen to bishop 3. Bishop to bishop 2.
Impulse engines are down.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, downloading his consciousness into a malfunctioning computer.
And, as a special guest, here to actually download your consciousness, Vicky Sue.
Hi, fresh from Tokyo, konnichiwa.
She's not fresh from Tokyo, she's just making that up, guys. Vicky, for those who don't recall, you're on the show last to talk about, what was it you were talking about? I don't recall.
We were ranking the captains.
Yes, that's right. I knew it was captain related. And it was a great show, talked all about, obviously where we place different captains in order is a great response from people. We're glad that you're back on the show once again.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. And I also just want to give a shout out to Blue Apron. Any gourmet foods you may be looking to cook, they're easy to do. You can just go to blueapron.com, order there, and they'll send you one of your individual dishes. Very easy to make the recipe. And look, you have the recipe card with you, so you can just buy those ingredients at the store. Once again, that's at blueapron.com.
I like a good casserole.
Yeah, very good stuff. Mm-hmm. I've had a great casserole dish as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very exciting.
Yeah. Before we jump into this week's conundrum, Cam, maybe a little bit of housekeeping, because I think news broke last week that Star Trek Discovery has cast its first cast member on the show. Nothing official from CBS yet, but Michelle Yeoh, as well as Nick Myers, they've kind of alluded to the fact that she, the actress known for, say, Tomorrow Never Dies, as well as Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Also, The Mechanic Resurrection.
One of your top tens of this year.
Obviously.
Only for Tommy Lee Jones' appearance in that
film. Yes, yes. Yeah. And let's not forget Supercop. Like, her performance in Supercop is amazing.
Yeah. So, broke down barriers, and which I hope she does again with her new role... supposedly as Captain Han Bao of the USS Shinzu in Star Trek Discovery. So, Cam, when we first heard word that Michelle Yeoh was going to be cast in this, I said, well, a strong possibility she could be the lead character that we know to be as only number one at this point. And I said, well, at the very least, if she's not that, then probably the captain of the Discovery. Doesn't seem as if she is either one of those.
No, she's not. It would seem quite obvious that that's, yeah, going to be the case. I mean, to me, at this point, she seems like good sort of stunt casting, but I'm not getting a vibe she's going to be a major character on the series. It's sort of like she's there to kind of legitimize the show a bit. Like, we can get real actors on this thing, even if they're just kind of smaller supporting roles.
So do you think that she's actually going to be performing any martial arts?
No, I don't think so.
I
although I'd be okay with that.
Sure. I just wonder if we're talking about Star Trek trying to break down stereotypes. I don't know if you want like the first Asian woman captain to be doing kung fu.
Right. Well, probably not, but it is her signature.
It is, yeah. Sure. So look, I could imagine her on the holodeck or what have you doing that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean maybe it's a little like fencing scene. I could kind of picture that, but that's not really.
How do you go from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon to one of those Picard fencing
exactly.
scenes.
Would it be a Sulu fencing scene?
Oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm. So, no, that could be it.
What do you guys think about this actress, though? Vicky, start with you. Any thoughts about Michelle Yeoh?
I really like Michelle Yeoh, but I do have to say that the last movie I watched her in was in the Netflix-produced Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 2, which was not my favorite. I think that there is some good... martial arts performance in there. However, the movie itself, it really just kind of, two thumbs down from me.
Okay. Hear that, Michelle Yeoh?
I'm sorry. Michelle Yeoh is awesome, but the movie, no.
Okay.
It did not pay homage to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 1. whatsoever.
Yeah, she's an actress who I think has been really saddled with a lot of crappy roles as of late. And I think it's because Hollywood just honestly has no idea what to do with her.
Yeah.
I hope Star Trek has a better idea.
I would have to believe, look, it will. Mm-hmm. You know, look, they got a name actress. Yeah. Recognizable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I look forward to whatever she's doing. I just don't know what exactly she'll be doing because she's not the captain of the titular vessel.
Mm-hmm.
So is she going to be recurring? Or, like, how often are they going to be meeting up with this one ship?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of question marks here. I'm looking forward to having her presence aboard the series, you mm-hmm. know. And Cam, I texted you this as well. I said, I can't wait until we get, like, the angry misogynists complaining that both the lead character, number one, is, you know, a woman, as well as, you know, possibly the captain of the ship. You know, there'd
right.
be people complaining that the two highest-ranking people on the show are, like, women. And
right.
they're going to be complaining about these liberal agendas, you know, that Star Trek's trying to push. Guys, Star Trek's a very liberal show. It's always been progressive, so...
And its fans always are, too.
Oh, well, judging by judging by Facebook... I don't know if that's always the case.
Not always.
Yeah, but I hope that, you know, they really do something to kind of push things. It doesn't sound as if, you know, we're going to have, you know, a woman captain at this point,
mm-hmm.
but we'll see. I hope it is, because, look, we had Kirk and Spock as the two highest-ranking officers. We had Riker and Picard. Why can't we have two women? Like, I would love to see that.
Right. Well, we may. We may eventually.
We may, yeah.
And Michelle Yeoh was actually really good in Sunshine, too. Danny Boyle's science fiction movie. Yeah, that I
one
have...
One of the bright spots in Sunshine.
Oh, that's bad. But, yeah, like, that movie has real problems in its third act, but I think she's very good in it, and it's a very beautiful-looking movie.
For anyone who likes Sunshine, you should listen to our episode, one of the highest downloaded we've ever done, Cam, Space Madness.
Oh, right, yes, yes, yeah. That does tie into the theme of Sunshine.
There you go.
I'll have to check it out.
So why do we get to this week's conundrum? Technology gone awry.
What does this mean, Cameron?
Well, I did pitch it, so I should know. So often in Star Trek, you know, it's this future utopia where technology helps us in so many wonderful ways, and yet, on an almost weekly basis, technology fails us, and we have to figure it out.
Yes. It feels like almost my daily life. You mm-hmm. know, somehow my computer freezes or my iPhone sends really inappropriate text messages to people out of my control.
Right,
don't know what happened
right,
there.
Right.
Late at night.
That's
late
what
at night.
Happened yeah. there.
Photos.
I just happened to be drinking.
It just happened.
Yes.
It fell into my mouth.
Yeah. What? Wait, what?
You know, Romulan ale will do things.
Yes, yes.
So I thought it would be fun to kind of talk about some episodes and the technology that went awry in each one and talk about, you know, the use of this technology within Star Trek. Does it work? And then just maybe talk about the episodes and whether, you know, they were a little ridiculous or whether they
yeah.
worked.
Well, Cam, why don't we start with you? I'm curious what your first pick is.
Okay, well, I'm going to start with a TNG episode. The first episode of Season 3, Evolution.
Mm-hmm. With the nanites.
Yes, so this is a Wesley Crusher's episode, really. And what happens is a specialist named Stubbs, Dr. Stubbs, has come to the Enterprise to do some sort of astrophysical research that made no sense to me on a stellar explosion. And Wesley, in the meantime, has been working on a school project where he creates nanites. Two of them escape into the ship's computer and basically take over the entire ship. The nanites start attacking Dr. Stubbs. Life support's failing. Everything's going wrong. It's creating false Borg alerts. And I really don't like this episode because I'm troubled by a ship in the 24th century that's fallen by Wesley Crusher's school experiment.
Yeah, well, okay, well, episode not a great one, but what do you think about the potential of Wesley's nanites here? His school project that he was working
Why
on.
Why did he create them?
For fun.
For fun.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Didn't you try to create nanites when you were,
oh,
you know,
yeah,
14?
All the time. Unsuccessfully.
Oh, okay.
And the fact that he creates the most advanced nanites known to man, no less.
Yes.
I mean, he better get an A, right?
You'd think, but...
But instead, they almost destroy them all. And, I don't know. To me, Look, I don't actually have that much of a problem with Wesley creating the most scientifically brilliant nanites known to man. That doesn't really faze me too much. It's the issue that 24th century technology, this ship, this, you know, the number one ship in the fleet, is completely fallible to a 16-year-old's science experiment.
And it's not the first time that that's happened with Wesley before.
No.
Think about the Naked Now. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Wesley, you know, becomes, I guess, kid drunk, essentially, right. And he's able to kind of commandeer engineering.
Right.
Sort of like you before
like
you said those texts.
I like that episode.
The Naked Time, or The Naked Now?
The Naked Now, yeah.
Hey, Picard and Beverly, they're getting amorous in that one. So it's kind of planting the seeds for maybe what...
I think
what,
I remember that episode because Data starts rearranging all the microchips.
Yes.
I loved it whenever he did that. Yeah. You know, it was impressive. I thought you were going to mention something else with Data in that episode.
What was that?
Remember Tasha Yar?
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Technology did okay, not fail
no,
there.
No, yeah.
That's true. That's true.
Found out that he's fully functional.
He's fully functional.
Yes.
Well, yeah, Wesley has a history of creating kind of these technological disasters aboard the Enterprise. Would you not think that this the most advanced ship in the fleet would be able to avoid this kid from really butchering it a lot of the time?
I would like to think they have some sort of fail-safe that if, like, an outside element gets into the system, that it closes it off. Or at least sounds an alert before the whole thing goes haywire.
Yeah.
So, to me, like, this really made me question the technology of Starfleet.
Okay.
Very severely.
So, now that you mention that, when you guys first talked about this episode with me, I always thought of an episode where Barclay actually takes over the ship. It's called The Nth Degree.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... This I see a lot of parallels in this episode and in The Nth Degree.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of... I think that one might be a better episode. Who? This one is the one that's more, at least, made me the kind of roll my eyes the most.
That's true.
Who'd you rather, you know, control the ship, like, cause damage to the ship with technology? Barclay or Wesley? Who do you trust more?
I would rather have Barclay do it myself, because... Okay. Even though he's quirky and odd, he's, I don't know, I just trust his instincts better than Wesley's.
Really?
He has better intentions, or he has better judgment.
Right.
Like Wesley is still very curious, and he doesn't really know where he's taking things.
Right, like, Barclay is just kind of a spaz, but he's good at his job.
Yep.
We've seen that. He created Pathfinder, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
But Wesley is,
my
you know...
My favorite arc from Voyager, obviously.
Wesley's moody and prone to throwing temper tantrums. That's he does
true.
That in this episode, but at Beverly. So I don't really want this guy having control over the Enterprise.
Well, in Wesley's defense, he can really take a banana split in the face.
That's true.
Yeah.
Now, before we just leave Evolution, I actually have a funny Evolution story that happened to me just today, the day we are recording this.
Okay.
So there's a coffee place I go to near my work almost every day, and I was meeting with some of my coworkers just to hang out today at lunchtime. And I started discussing this episode with one of the guys there who was a TNG watcher. And we were kind of trying to remember this one a bit, because I hadn't watched it at that point for this episode. And we were trying to remember what, you know, how they resolved the whole thing. Suddenly the guy next to us turns and says, well, they plug into Data, and Data is able to, you know, have the nanite speak through him.
Right.
We were like, wow, awesome. You know, who knew? The guy sitting next to us was a Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
So we continue talking, and then one of the girls who works at the coffee place, who's the manager, comes and sits with this guy. And this guy's, you know, middle-aged, whatever. And then they start to talk, and it seems that he's a real problem, and that she is actually meeting with him because he exploded at one of the girls that works at the coffee place yesterday and was screaming at her and caused such a scene that the manager asked to meet with him at the coffee place.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
And apparently it was because the girl was, like, making too much noise with cups clattering and wouldn't change the music. And it was so awkward. And then I just, like, was, like, laughing to my friend after, like, why is it the Star Trek fans are the ones that are crazy? The ones I relate with the most.
I wonder.
Yeah, it really says a lot about you.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. Right. It was actually me.
I believe it.
So what did the manager have to say to you then?
I gotta say, she handled it so well. Better than I would have. I would have rolled my eyes and been like, this is ridiculous. She was so diplomatic and, you know, I think everyone walked away happy.
Okay.
I would have been like, you know, throwing up my hands over the whole thing.
You'd have resolved it with a cup of water to the face.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
You bring up Data, mm-hmm. and this is what is going to kind of segue into my next topic here. I didn't go about it so much episode by episode, but I was looking at like various levels of technology and where things could go awry. I think androids. There yeah. is a big problem with androids. Yeah. When we think about Dr. Noonien Soong, who built, you know, these androids based on his own looks, interesting. Mm-hmm. So you have Lore, who turned into a sociopath.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We have Data, who, as soon as you put the emotion chip in him, he turns into a blubbering idiot.
Right.
You also have Lol, Data's offspring, from the episode The Offspring. Mm-hmm. She was not able to survive for very long, and she was so advanced that she ended up essentially prematurely exiting this reality.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You also have one, Juliana Traynor. This, of course, is Dr. Soong's right. sex robot who left him for another man. Like, when your sex robot leaves you, you know you've made it malfunction.
Been there.
Okay. More than I needed to know.
You've also got, like, the episode, like, Requiem for Methuselah in the original series with, again, the female robot that goes awry. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very common thing, yeah.
Or even, like, what are little girls made of in the original series? Yeah. You've got the duplicates being made, androids. Mm-hmm. Another great example here, I think one of your favorites, Cam, Voyager's prototype, in right. which we do have those androids essentially going to war with themselves for eternity because they destroyed their own makers.
Right, yes.
So, Vicky, what do you think? If an android was available, would you purchase one? Would you have it do household functions for you? Or would you want to stay away from these conscious beings?
I think I would want to stay away just because there, you don't make progress when life becomes too easy.
I think that's very, very, relates to something going on in my own life in which, I know this family, they're dealing with adversity mm-hmm. and they're not well equipped to do so.
Right.
And, I guess if they had like an android doing everything for them, they would never be able to, you know, fight what they need to fight.
Exactly. You know? You have to battle your own demons.
Exactly.
You can't always have somebody else do it for you.
But Cam.
Right.
Sex robot?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
No, I had a note about this myself, because, you know, when you look at some of the episodes with Data, you've got, like, Masks, you've got Insurrection, the film.
Yes.
You've got Fistful of Data's, Descent, Phantasms. Each case, something goes wrong with Data, really bad things happen. Like, people's lives are at risk. Not in a way that, say, you know, if Worf or Troy or Riker, whatever, if they get in trouble, yeah, someone may get hurt or something. With Data, it could take down everyone. And so it really led me to question, having an android on a starship, at least one as powerful as Data, who yeah. can essentially really, really do a lot of damage.
Hey, Lily Sloan shot him with a magazine full of bullets, and he just said, hello.
Yeah.
This guy, look, do you understand why, was it Commander Maddox who came aboard in A Measure of a Man and, mm-hmm. and tried to prove that he was Starfleet property?
Yeah.
I can understand why some people are concerned about androids, though.
I think you're forgetting some androids, actually. If you remember, there was an episode where Geordi, he was working with these robots, and they were drilling, and they somehow managed to bypass some of the commands, and they would stop drilling because they had a sense of self-preservation.
That's right, oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. That one rings a bell. Yeah,
I was going to mention it, but Cam insisted we only talk about sex robots. Like, it's blame Cam, essentially.
Maybe they could be modified.
I do recall what they looked like.
I'm sure I'm sure Geordi tried.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, the question is, like, you know, Data has had all these instances where he's tried to, or, you know, inadvertently caused a lot of danger to the ship. At what point in a realistic world do you think Starfleet would step in and be like, look, we like this guy, but he's really dangerous?
I think it's because, you know, the Federation is an embodiment of Gene Roddenberry's kind of vision of the future, which yeah. is a very liberal progressive sort of thing, where mm-hmm. no matter what, you know, there'd be these human rights that you know, everyone has. And I can't really argue against that, but
actually have rights? Because weren't there a few episodes that kind of address that?
Yeah, like Measure of a Man, like they literally tried to claim him as Starfleet property. And I think that probably kind of settled the issue from there. Like, he is like his own sentient, you know, he is a sentient being. He is no one's property, essentially. So I think it's, the whole idea of androids brings up a lot of fascinating, like, conversations. They can go awry, and the fact that they are designed to look, like, identical to humans, or humanoids, that can be another dangerous thing as well.
Well, there's probably a lot of controversy around that as well in the 24th century, just because Dr. Pulaski didn't seem to like Data very much.
No, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
And there's also the question is the problem just that in the case of Data, he's overpowered? Because I don't think, like, Sherry Jackson's character from, like, What Little Girls Are Made Of is dangerous if you put her on a Starfleet ship.
Yeah.
You know, she may be stronger and could, like, bend a bar or something with, you know, in her hands, but I don't think she's going to take over the entire system's computer and put, you know, the life support into threat.
So Dune it all comes down to the positronic brain. Like, that was Soong's, like, big, big advance right there. And not all those androids that we encounter have positronic brains. Maybe that's what makes Data, Lore, etc. so dangerous.
Is the positronic brain one step too far?
Perhaps it is, Cam. Perhaps it is. Okay, that's androids, we deem them dangerous, but we love Data, nonetheless.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Not Lore, though.
Okay.
And B4?
Yeah, what about B4?
No.
Okay.
Well, still the same.
Cam, what's next for you?
Okay, well, I want to talk about the Doctor, the Voyager character, much beloved.
The EMH.
That's right. And the episode Latent Image. This is the episode where the Doctor suspects something's wrong with him because Harry Kim has a healed wound that he doesn't remember working on. And it turns out that a crewman had died. The Doctor had to choose between two patients, Kim and another one, an ensign. And he chose Kim. The woman died. And he was so essentially distraught, it caused like a feedback loop between his ethical and cognitive subroutines. And he was essentially going crazy.
Yeah.
And so Janeway reprograms him to erase the event. And that kind of makes him just paranoid, suspicious, and unsure of what's going on. And it causes like a real, conflict of ethics between, Janeway and the Doctor over who has the right to do this to him. Does she have the right as the captain? And ultimately they reactivate him and he possibly lives with the incident. But guys, what did you think of this episode?
I thought it was a very strong one for Voyager, especially good Doctor episode as well. And it brings up a lot of questions. My big issue though is this ensign that he did not save. She was supposed to be a big part of the crew, but like they never really ever spoke of her. She never appeared prior to that.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
yeah, when I was reading about Ensign Jatel, I was like, who?
Yeah. But, but it kind of brings up, I think the bigger question here is, you know, the EMH, the whole idea of, like, we've delved into holodecks quite a bit, but the whole idea of, like, this specific sort of hologram that is self-aware, that is sentient. Mm-hmm. We have that with Vic Fontaine as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the Doctor, especially that mobile emitter that he has, it is prone to malfunctioning.
It is.
But is it worth it, Vicky? Do you think if you have a Doctor that's a hologram, no matter the risks of him malfunctioning, it would be worth it, especially if you're on the other side of the galaxy?
Yes, I think it has a lot to do with your circumstance. And for Janeway, it was a matter of survival. She needed to have this functioning EMH. So in this case, I would have to agree with her.
Cam?
I think it raises a lot of questions about the idea of the Doctor evolving, essentially, versus using it more as, like, a tool. Now, of course, that gets into the ethics of the character. Because it's played by Robert Ricardo, and because we love him so much, we want to see this character develop and grow.
Yeah.
Say if the Doctor was a completely static, robotic figure, I don't think we would feel the same way.
Like, if he was season one Doctor throughout the entire run of the series.
Sure, yeah, you wouldn't be like, you know, why does Janeway keep trying to hold this character down?
Yeah.
But we love the Doctor, and so, you know, this is a really painful episode to watch because he's really off, like, really upset and distraught throughout this episode. And when, you know, we find out what Janeway did, we feel really awful for him. We feel for him.
But since he's a hologram, technically he doesn't actually have any emotion. He only emulates it.
Very true.
Well, does he, though? Because I wonder about that. Like, is he only faking the emotions, or not faking the emotions, but as you say, emulating the emotions based on his own programming? Or is the Doctor a little different because his program's been running for so long, like far longer than it was ever intended? He was supposed to, the E in EMH stands for emergency. Mm-hmm. He was never meant to be running for as long as he did. I wonder if there's something maybe special about this iteration of the Doctor.
It's an excellent question. I wish Voyager had done a little more with that. They did a lot with the Doctor. Like, I'm not going to fault the show for not exploring him further.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it would have, you know, there's so many cool things they could have done with the Doctor that maybe they just didn't have time for or didn't occur to them.
Right.
So what would you guys... Okay, knowing that the EMH Mark II eventually becomes Andy Dick, as featured in Message in a Bottle,
right.
In which he goes to the Alpha Quadrant on the USS Pegasus, I believe, or USS Prometheus, actually.
Yeah.
And then he encounters Andy Dick.
But you're going to say he encounters the aliens from Alien.
On the Prometheus, uh-huh. Yes. Gotcha. That's a good one, Cam.
The Xenomorphs.
Yeah. Anyways... Knowing the dangers that the Doctor will one day become Andy Dick, is it still worth it having an EMH?
If it's Andy Dick, it's off all the time.
Okay.
Yeah, there is no mobile emitter.
No emergency big enough that would make you turn on EMH Mark II?
No. Okay. I mean, I don't know. Do you think Janeway... You know, there was a lot of tension throughout Voyager with Janeway's handling of the Doctor, and often, you know, not wanting to give him a name or not make him essentially a member of the crew.
Yeah.
It is a little cold.
Yeah. Do you think she was being practical, or do you think she was being cold?
I don't think that she really understood. Maybe she was just seeing, you know, the Doctor as an object. She didn't really see him as a person with rights like Data, because he's not physically present.
Well, when do you guys think that the crew started seeing him less as an object and more as, like, a fellow crew member? Because I remember if you go back and watch, like, season one, season two... They're very dismissive of him. They
don't turn him off when
exactly.
They leave, and
yeah.
He always gets upset.
What do you think it was? Maybe around season. When did the Doctor start to get like a real distinct personality? I guess is when. Yeah, that.
Well, obviously the Beowulf episode.
Oh God, don't remind me.
Which one was that?
It's the one where they go into like a holodeck program with Beowulf,
and like he has like this female guide.
It's
and
not good.
It's like his first standalone episode in season one.
Okay.
It's probably like what? Like, I feel like the relationship with Kes brings a lot to the Doctor.
Yeah.
So probably sometime in season two.
Yeah.
Maybe mm-hmm. is when he sort of really kind of blossoms.
I'm just thinking, maybe like he starts singing a lot as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, this episode, Latent Image, lands midway through season five. So by this point, the Doctor is fully, Doctor-ified.
Yes.
And so it's actually kind of surprising to see Janeway being as harsh towards him at this point in the show versus, like, if this had landed in, like, season two, I think we might be a little more sympathetic to Janeway.
So what would you have done?
What would I have done? Oh, boy. I don't know. I think I would... If I'm in Janeway's position, I would probably do what Janeway did because I think I would feel I had to. If my EMH is basically on the fritz... I'm going to be going like, well, I guess I have to fix the problem for the good of everyone else on the ship. Tom Paris is a very busy man. He can't heal
right,
everything.
Right,
yeah.
Can they not replace him? Like, just conjure up a new EMH?
Or get, like, that Beowulf woman to, you know, help the crew out.
Yeah. So, EMHs, good idea?
I'd say it depends on the model. I could live with a Dr. Bashir EMH because, again, they're trying to model the next Mark, like the Mark II Dr. Bashir mm-hmm. until they found out that he was genetically engineered.
Right.
I like EMH Mark I, the actual Mark II with Andy Dick. We're going down a very slippery slope, guys.
Don't they just reduce him to scrubbing plasma conduits in the end anyway?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
That's rather depressing.
So in a future where, say, like, you had the choice between a human doctor or, EMH, what would you choose?
A human doctor.
You would choose a human doctor?
Yeah.
It'd give me Dr. Pulaski any day.
No Dr. Pulaski. I hated Dr. Pulaski.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I guess human doctor, although I don't know. EMH wouldn't be that bad.
Oh, okay, pick a human doctor that we've encountered that you would go with.
Crusher's not bad.
Crusher's pretty good.
I'd say out of all of them that we've seen.
Yeah.
But then Bashir is genetically engineered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would still choose Crusher over him.
I think we saw a lot more of Bashir's character, where we saw a lot more of Beverly's, like, technical know-how. Like,
right.
She is, like, we see her in the professional setting much more. We see how she is a very competent doctor. Right. So
I wouldn't mind Phlox either.
Yeah, Phlox is okay.
He give you the best smile ever.
There you go.
Or the whatever bloodworms.
Yeah. Yeah, Cam.
No, that's why I'm at the doctor in the first place.
Okay.
So, Tyler, let's get to your next one.
Okay. Look, I don't think it's any shock to anybody, but the warp drive, known to malfunction more than once.
What?
Yeah. Obviously, look, we can start with the motion picture in one of my favorite scenes ever, in which a meteor comes into the warp drive field and
everybody talks like this
for, right, what, 14 minutes or so?
Okay? About that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Rounding down.
But more to the point, look, we've got a lot of other episodes, like, say, Cam, we've dug deep into Threshold many a time. We don't need to go over that again. But essentially, Tom Paris, he breaks the Warp 10 barrier, turns into a giant salamander. Vicky, was that one of your favorites, or were you not a big fan of the
episode? I don't remember that one.
Wow.
Well, we'll get you on the commentary for that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rewatch it.
That one lives in infamy among a lot of Star Trek fans. It's one of the worst episodes. But Cam and I, we've rewatched it too many times.
Was it just him that turns into a salamander?
Oh, he ends up taking away Janeway as his mate and turns her into a salamander, too.
Oh.
And they have salamander babies. Oh. Not to spoil it for you. I apologize.
Yeah. Oh no, so there's Salamander, Janeway, Paris offspring somewhere out in the universe.
Somewhere.
Well, we actually have them in my shelf in my bedroom. Like, I've got the action figure of mutated Tom Paris.
Oh, I see.
That comes with his offspring, too. Mm. So, I actually have Neelix in my bedroom as well, and he comes with pots and pans, and I actually put the offspring in his pants.
That's a room.
Yeah, it is. I apologize.
It's funny, though, the Warp 10 barrier. Like, in the original series, there's an episode where, like, the warp goes out of control, and they get to, like, Warp 30-something.
Yeah.
It's like, no one's turning the salamanders there.
Yeah. Another one worth mentioning is the Traveler. He likes to mess with warp drive in where no one has gone before. He is kind of leading Wesley down that path as well, and they end up in, well, literally some sort of dimension that no one has gone before.
That was a creepy episode.
It was, mostly because of the Traveler and his his strange fixation on one Wesley Crusher.
I've been watching you, Wesley.
You are very special.
I thought it was creepy when Picard saw his mother, but I think that's a personal issue
Okay. But that is just a creepy episode, even like Picard going through, say, the turbo lift and almost getting sucked out into like warp speed as but think about it again. Traveler turns up once more in Remember Me. That's the one where Beverly notices that everyone around the ship starts disappearing. That again is created by this effort by Wesley and the Traveler to create this kind of warp bubble,
right?
So this warp drive, it can be very tricky at times, but it has the added benefit of taking you faster than light speed to, you know, all these other planets across the galaxy.
In what world would they be putting Wesley and the Traveler on this assignment?
I don't know, Cam.
Like, if I'm on the flagship vessel, I'm not like, hey, kid, can you and your creepy friend make us a thing to go faster?
I know.
Like, this does not make sense.
It's Starfleet, man.
Is Starfleet too loose on its rules when it comes to technology?
Yeah.
They're very progressive.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are we just going to have to chalk everything up to progress here? All in the name of progress, people.
But why are they practicing on the Enterprise? Why aren't they on, like, the Bozeman or something?
Yeah, I know. Or one of those Oberth-class ships that they always kind of dismiss as, like, a science vessel.
Right, right.
I'm obsessed with the Oberth class. Do you guys recall which ones those look like?
I'm obsessed with the Oberth class. There's something no one has ever said in the entirety of human existence.
No, they're so bizarre looking. I believe they first appeared in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. And it was the ship that Savick was assigned to. Mm-hmm. And it's where you have a saucer section, and then you have a body, and then they're connected by, like, these nacelles.
Right.
Like, how do you travel between the saucer and the body? Because, like, the nacelles are in the way.
Is it like the Reliant?
No, it's
similar kind of look, though?
No.
Okay.
It's distinct. I'll show a picture to you guys later on. But,
right,
like, it's a very bizarre ship, but they'd show up occasionally on Star Trek The Next Generation, and they weren't even like officially like Starfleet vessels. They just called them, oh, that's a science vessel.
Right.
Is that the one of the ones where in the alternate reality where Crusher, she has her medical ship?
Or like the Pasteur?
Oh, yeah. No, it's not that class. But it doesn't... I like the Pasteur. I like how it has that like spherical like saucer.
Mm-hmm.
What was the name of the ship in the original series that had a similar design, Cam?
I am not remembering.
Was that? Okay, I'm blanking on it. But but you do recall an episode featuring one similar, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, look, warp drive. Would you? Okay. Knowing the possibilities that it could malfunction, is warp drive still worth it, guys?
It's worth it for me.
Yeah?
Yeah, you have to have it.
There would be no show without warp drive.
What would be the first planet you two would travel to? Not together, necessarily, but I mean, like...
God, I don't know. This is never...
Go to Ryza.
Oh, okay. That's a good call. Yeah. You gotta go to Ryza first.
Okay, that was the first one that jumped into my mind. So.
Yeah.
We'll do a remote episode from Ryza.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, speaking about Star Trek technology.
Yes, that's what we've been doing for the last like 40 minutes, Cam.
Don't put down my segue. I want to talk about an original series episode called The Ultimate Computer. Have either of you seen this episode?
I have not.
Probably not.
Okay. Well, it's one worth pointing out because there are a lot of episodes where Kirk talks the computer to death. I feel we would be remiss to not talk about one of those. And this is one where Dr. Richard Daystrom comes on board to outfit the Enterprise with a new computer system called the M5 that is a tactical computer and may replace captains. It's the idea that like these ships could be regulated by a computer intelligence and, you know, not require, you know, human errors and that sort of thing. And it's a really good episode about sort of Kirk feeling like he's going to be replaced and kind of struggling with the idea of this happening. And ultimately, M5 goes a little crazy. They're engaging it in war games with other Starfleet ships to test its abilities. And it starts protecting itself and essentially starts to go to war against these ships. And the episode is really about, you know, the crew trying to get control back and Dr. Daystrom kind of crumbling as his masterpiece creation is, you know, not working. And it's just an absolutely fantastic episode. And the reason I picked it is because I think it's the best of the Kirk talks the computer to death episodes.
Yeah.
There's, you know, Return of the Archons is another one. Changeling is another. iMUD, he does it. But I think this is the one that actually is used in a way where it's actually commenting on the characters and their mission in the universe.
Well, I think we can wrap that into kind of the broader topic of, like, say, artificial intelligence on Star Trek. Because there's a similar episode in Voyager, Warhead.
Mm-hmm.
That featured the Doctor having his programming taken over by this quote-unquote smart bomb, this warhead that was able to have artificial intelligence and search out enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting, you have these very tactical sort of computers, you know, that are very, very dangerous. Is AI worth it? Can I say this, guys? I'm very fearful that Skynet's going to go active one of these days. Like, I don't think it's, like, that out of the question. I think artificial intelligence could be a very dangerous thing. And I think it's interesting that they have touched upon it a lot in Star Trek. And I wish in Star Trek Discovery that they go even deeper into some of the questions that it brings up about the dangers of it as well.
Hopefully.
What do you guys think about having a ship controlled by AI?
I would hate it. Like, it kind of, look, the fact that you get rid of a captain, you know, that's concerning to me as well. Because just think about how much...
What if it's Captain Stiles? Or Harriman.
Okay. We'll call it a draw.
Okay.
Yeah. But no, I think just kind of that human touch, you know, is needed for somebody leading the ship.
Definitely.
We talked about that when we were ranking the captains as well. Just kind of the idea that you need, all five of the captains have that distinct
style.
You need
intuition.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, why is it you guys are okay with, like, the EMH, but not, say, the M5?
That's a very good question, though.
EMH is out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I did say that I would choose a human doctor
over
an EMH.
And yeah. I honestly think it could just come down to anthropomorphism, where, you know, we're seeing kind of this AI being embodied in something that we can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Picardo is a very, very charismatic actor. So
right.
that makes it, look, if it was being played by the actor who played Captain Stiles, then right. maybe I wouldn't feel the same way.
Mm-hmm. Now, the concept of talking a computer to death, this is a staple of the original series. What do you guys think about this this trope within the series? I know you guys haven't seen necessarily this episode, but you've probably at least heard the joke yeah. about Kirk talking computers to death, doing essentially logical gymnastics to make computers explode.
Is that the actual purpose?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's like Kirk is so good, you know, that he can talk a computer into submission.
Okay, that sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, what, like, is this a trope that works at all?
I think the problem is, like, this episode was written 50 years ago
yes.
when people envisioned computers as a very different sort of thing.
Yeah.
There's no way I would ever have the capacity in my own small head to talk a computer to death.
No.
Until it started, like, you know, smoke started coming out of it or anything.
Right.
You know? I don't know, Vicky, are you a fan of, super powerful computers?
Yeah, sure I am.
Okay. You need them for work.
You need them, yeah. You know?
But I think we've seen, not just for regulating a ship on Ultimate Computer, but, like, I think you can see in other episodes, like, Spock's Brain, for example, like, having computer intelligence overseeing a society is also a bad idea.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's present, of course, and also in Return of the Archons.
It's that kind of cold-hearted logic, you mm-hmm. know, devoid of emotion. It's part of being human.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm not a big fan of, you know, computers taking over everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No.
Okay. Well, I'm also not a big fan of some certain security measures. You know, I mentioned the warhead just a moment ago. There's also weapons in Star Trek,
okay.
as well as, recall the B'Elanna Torres episode, Dreadnought, in which an AI-powered missile from the Cardassians ends up in the Delta Quadrant. So we've got weapons like that. We also have Ezri Dax with her ballistic rifle in Field of Fire, in which she can creepily look into people's quarters everywhere aboard Deep Space Nine with this eyepiece that comes with the ballistic rifle.
Well, that was a weapon designed by Geordi.
Oh, obviously.
I was just thinking that. I'm like, hmm.
Yeah. But speaking of Deep Space Nine, because I don't think there's as many technology-focused episodes of Deep Space Nine, but do you recall the episode Civil Defense, in which they accidentally trigger this automated security system that locks down the entire station, and they even have, like, this replicator turns into, like, this, essentially a firing squad, and, like, starts shooting everybody.
As a replicator will do.
Obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and even when Dekat arrives on the space station, he can't even get it to shut down as the former prefect
mm-hmm.
there. So weapons, I think they're a very scary thing in the Star Trek universe, but are they a necessity if you are out traveling in deep space?
I think you definitely need them. I mean, in a perfect world, you have, like, the Makos from, like, Enterprise.
Really?
I don't know. Like, I like the idea of the Mako. They make sense to me, like, as a... You know, they have the human instinct. I think the problem was the Makos weren't very good at their jobs.
Well, I felt that they undermined Starfleet a lot.
They definitely draw the argument, the whole, like, military versus science vessel. But, I mean, in a situation where you are facing conflict, to me, like, the Makos feel like a more likely real-world scenario than what we get in the other Star Trek series, where it's, like, Riker and, like, Geordi firing phasers wildly.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
You know what I mean? Like, because not all intelligences they're going to encounter are going to be civil. You know, do you really think that the Enterprise crews we see in the other series would be capable of, like, handling a conflict?
But I would hope that, like, if they're beaming down to planets, that they're... I don't like the kind of idea of colonialism and imperialism
right.
that we see so much of in Star Trek a
yes.
lot of the times. I don't think Makos should be making first contact with a lot of these groups.
No, to me, they're essentially like a security group. Like, we have security on the ships or whatever, but
yeah.
they're a little more specialized, and they're trained for combat in a way that the security never seemed to be.
That's true.
They were just, like, knocked over one after another, whereas, like, the Makos, to me, would be more specialized, but they aren't there as, like, a military necessity. It's there as...
What are they there for?
Yeah, that's what I wonder. What are they doing?
Break glass in case of trouble.
I would say keep them on the ship.
Yes.
But don't put them on planets. Because
sure.
I think that's very dangerous for some aliens if they see these specialized mm-hmm. hostile forces coming down to their planet just to, you know, stir some stuff up.
Well, I mean, the ship should be like the brain trust and should be really, really well protected. In a way, yeah. It's not. We see throughout Star Trek that the ship gets invaded constantly. Mm-hmm. That's my idea of like what the Makos are there for. They're there to keep the scientists completely locked down and safe.
Hmm. I'm just saying this, though. The most famous Mako of all, Balthazar Edison.
Yes.
Vicky, have you seen Star Trek Beyond yet?
I have.
Okay. Of course, Balthazar Edison turns into Krall.
Right.
I don't know if Makos are well-equipped for deep space travel. Just in my own opinion.
He didn't pass the psych exam I would give him.
Yeah.
No. He was made captain, though, of the Franklin.
That was a mistake.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done that.
Okay. So, yeah, security or tactical procedures, 24th century. Look, you're in deep space. You need to protect yourself, but some of these things should be better thought out. Would you guys agree?
I would agree. Okay. I would agree with that.
Yeah, I would agree, yeah, for sure. Well, I want to talk about the actual ship's computer, because, I mean, I touched upon it in Ultimate Computer, but we see throughout the series, you know, the characters will say, computer, tell us this or that. And I want to touch on actually an animated episode called Practical Joker, and this ties into actually another bit of Starfleet technology, too. And this is one where, you know, the ship goes through an energy cloud, and the ship's computer gets completely corrupted, and turns into a practical joker. It starts, like, doing things like stitching Kirk as a jerk on the back of his outfit. It has, like, the replicators throwing, like, pies and fruits at Scotty. It's essentially just pulling all these pranks. But one thing it does that's actually really dangerous is it takes over the holodeck. And this is the first time a holodeck is seen on the series. And we've done an episode before on holodecks going wrong. I'll post a link to that in the show notes. Go to subspacepod.com for that. But, you know, we get to see Sulu, McCoy, and Uhura trapped in a holodeck with the computer going on the fritz, and they're being basically pelted by a blizzard and almost freezing to death. And so it raises the question of, I guess, twofold. We can talk about the holodeck. Let's get to that after. But let's first talk about the computer being in a position of having so much power over us, but we're reliant on it out in deep space.
It also makes me think, as long as it's Majel Barrett, is the computer seen as too friendly to people? You know, in a way that, like, we kind of relate to the computer much more, where I really think this is can be a very dangerous sort of thing.
Yeah.
Although, Cam, you made me watch Practical Joker.
Oh, so you did watch it.
I reluctantly watched a non-canon episode this podcast. I think I need to wear a Kirk is a Jerk shirt to the next convention, because that actually literally made me laugh when I saw that. But yeah. With regards to the computer, look, we even see that in a Season 7 episode of Next Generation, where the computer starts to become sentient, like the Enterprise computer starts to become mm-hmm. sentient itself, and mm-hmm. it starts saving the Enterprise. The crew can't figure out why the Enterprise is doing all these weird things. I'm blanking on the name of the episode, but the computer is capable of being smart and having the best interests of not only itself, but the crew in mind. We see that in that Season 7 episode. But look, it's just like Wesley can damage the computer and make it do a whole lot of bad things. Mm-hmm. You know, there is some give and take there.
Maybe it would be more advantageous if they had more closed systems, because it seems that all of their systems are all integrated. And when one gets compromised, it seems that they are all compromised.
Right.
So maybe there's some fault there.
Also the fact that, like, you know, by the time we get to the adventures of Kirk or Picard, this is a little bit into the whole space exploration thing. Like, they should have ironed out the kinks. Like, the Enterprise should not be completely going off on the fritz when they go through, like, a space cloud or an anomaly. Oh, yeah.
I noticed that happens a lot on the animated series. Like, mm-hmm. they go through space clouds a lot, and the ship just totally, like, malfunctions.
But you know how you fix it. You go back through the space cloud.
That's what I realized as well. I figured it out.
But, you know,
they just hit the hard reset or something.
That sometimes too. That works as well. Yeah. But, I mean, there's
they unplug the USB cable and then plug it back in.
But you have to wait 2 seconds.
Yeah.
There's even an episode, though, of the original series where, I can't remember which one it is, where, like, the computer gets, I don't know, a little bit corrupted. Nothing as severe as Practical Joker or whatever. But it's, like, turns into this, like, sultry females, like, hitting on the crew member, like, hitting on mm-hmm. Kirk over the PA system.
Wow.
And it's, like, what kind of ship is this? Like, you know, I don't, you know, we all have, like, Siri on our iPhones. I don't think we worry about Siri going on the fritz and, like, ruining our lives.
I blame Siri for those text messages that some people have received.
Right.
Yeah. Sure.
Right.
So, sure.
There you go.
Okay, so Tyler, did you have anything else on your list?
Yeah, just maybe two little ones that I want to mention. Cloaking devices, we definitely see with Admiral Pressman showing up on the ship in Next Generation Season 6 episode, Pegasus, not to be confused with the Prometheus. We have that phased cloaking device where people can die horrifically with like half engulfed by meteors.
Right.
Be careful about those phased cloaking devices. The other thing I should mention, tractor beams. Those can be tricky because you can't have your shields raised when you're using the tractor beam.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Yeah, that can leave you vulnerable, just like in One Little Ship, in which the Defiant held the tractor beam on the runabout that was getting shrunk in that space anomaly. So the Dominion, the Jem'Hadar, were able to attack the Defiant with its shields down, and that runabout ended up just 4 inches long and had to go and fight off the Jem'Hadar aboard the Defiant. A fun episode, though.
It's very true. I mean, why is it that, you know, all of these systems created, you know, for this bright future are completely, like, they don't just cause problems. You know, computers cause problems in our day-to-day lives. They don't destroy them and put them at, like, the severe risk that seems to happen with Starfleet. You know...
Well, okay, I'm just going to, give you the answer to the question, and it's going to be a very unsatisfying answer, Ken.
Okay, I'm used to that from you.
I know. But essentially, I think it's because, look, they're looking for conflict aboard the ship, and a lot of the times it's going to come from external conflict.
Right.
It's not necessarily going to come from interpersonal conflict. It's just easier for them to have, oh, hey, look, technology's malfunctioning. That's creating conflict. How do we resolve that? You know, it's that kind of problem-solving storytelling versus... the stuff that I like much more, which is the character-to-character stuff. So,
but that wasn't allowed.
And that's why they were going, to the technology tropes so often.
Maybe that's why DS9 has less technology problems, because it was about humans working together.
Absolutely. And I'm curious how Discovery is going to approach things. Like, I really think it's a different era of television now.
Mm-hmm.
It also takes place before, the 24th century, when Gene Roddenberry deemed that all humans evolved beyond interpersonal conflict. So I think Discovery has a good opportunity to get away from some of these technology gone awry tropes that we see and that we've discussed for over the past hour.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I teased it earlier and we never actually talked about it. Tyler, you and I have talked about the holodeck quite a bit, Fistful of Data's, Long Goodbye, or Big Goodbye, and various episodes like that where it goes awry. But Vicky, I would actually like to hear what you have to say about, holodeck episodes where the holodeck goes wrong. Is it worth, the fantasies of the holodeck if, people's lives are constantly at risk?
You know what? They could probably do without the holodeck. I don't think that is an absolute necessity.
I agree.
Yeah. It's for their enjoyment, for their leisure, and I think that there are different ways of using their leisure time. Like they don't have to have it. They obviously didn't need it on the original Enterprise, and they found other ways of releasing tensions.
Singing, yeah. They sang.
Singing.
And we see Picard and Guinan. They like to go fencing.
Yeah,
that's one thing that they
Guinan
can
goes fencing. I don't remember that.
Yeah, Guinan and Picard fenced.
Oh, I didn't know she was that nimble.
It is strange that, I think it's in the episode The Neutral Zone in season 1 of TNG, they say TV was phased out in I think like 2040 something.
Yeah.
It's pretty soon. We're not that far off, guys. Within our lifetime, TV's gone. And it seems like movies basically stopped too, except for what existed up until, our time, because Trip Tucker on Enterprise, when he does movie nights, it's always older stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
At what point were they okay, we're completely phasing out, essentially most visual media to focus on, the holodeck?
Well, because the holodeck still didn't come around until, 24th century anyways. So what were they doing?
I guess you can make the argument 23rd if you're talking animated. But yes.
Cam? Non-canon.
But anyway,
so what were they doing?
There was going to be an episode actually written for the original where they actually wrote one in and they couldn't afford it. Well, so it was an idea, at least, that Gene Roddenberry was bounced around for the 23rd. But yes, canon-wise, it was introduced in the 24th. Yes.
Yes. So what were they doing in between, say, television/movies in the mid-21st century and the holodeck in the 24th century? That's a 300-year period.
And they're playing chess.
Yeah, 3D chess. That's a lot of 3D chess.
Yes.
I mean, there's in the Conscience of the King, they invite a local theater troupe to perform Shakespeare on the ship.
I think, I kind of that idea. Like, people are finding more creative ways to, you know, bide their time. Maybe they read more.
Would either of you find this fun?
No.
Theater?
No. No.
Sure.
Really?
I don't know.
Theater in, like, a cargo bay?
As long as, Travis Merriweather is there, like, lifting weights in that cargo bay, then have at it.
Yeah. Really? That's something you'd be interested in.
According to the episode Bound, yes.
And according to the text messages he sends late at night.
Yeah.
One last thing. Tyler, you and I did an episode also on transporters going awry. And I had a note here about the transporter, also from the motion picture you referenced that earlier. Janice Rand overseeing the transporter that does horrific things to two crew members.
You and I both agreed that if transporters actually existed, we would never use them.
Yeah. Now, Vicky, what is your take on transporters? You know, they created Tom Riker. So
yeah, they did. I would use them once the technology became more stable, but in the early stages, no.
Right. Would you use the grappler?
Oh my gosh, the grappler was hilarious. I would not use the grappler. I have seriously bad aim.
The physics of the grappler also made no sense whenever it appeared. Like,
yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, I want to know what kind of space-age material this grappler is made of.
Unobtainium.
Oh, good call, good call.
Very good.
So before we sign off, we had actually a really cool event that happened the day we were recording this. I had an evolution story at a coffee place, and we also inspired some artwork. So, you know, this morning we get an update on our Twitter page, and John Cullen, who's an artist based in, I think, Ireland, has put together a cartoon based on the episode. He said he was inspired by the episode we did last week on Tribble episodes, tracing the Tribble trilogy. And he's put together a Picard joke, because we talked about how Picard never encountered the Tribbles, and that was a great lost opportunity. And I thought this was pretty darn funny.
Yes. I would recommend, we've retweeted it on our Twitter page, so you can go to @subspacepod to check it out.
You can also go to John's website, which he has tons of his cartoons here. They're actually really funny. Now, the website is johncullen.com, but the John Cullen is backwards, so I'll spell it for you all. It's NELLUCNHOJ.com.
And it may just be easier for you guys to, like, search John Cullen in Twitter.
Yes.
And that's how I found him as soon as you sent me that message, Cam.
Yeah, he's also on Instagram.
Yeah.
And his stuff, he's got tons of stuff out there. It's a lot of fun.
Go check him out. Really good artwork. And I'm glad that he listens to the show. I'm very flattered. And hopefully we did not disappoint this week.
It's nice to know that two dimwits can inspire really talented people.
Exactly.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Well, we are going to look at one character that had so much potential that was inevitably just unrealized. We're going to examine one yeoman, later Lieutenant Commander Janice Rand.
Yeah, I've often said is like one of the most tragic characters in Star Trek, played by Grace Lee Whitney, and I think that's going to be a really interesting discussion. I don't know that we'll be laughing as much as this episode.
Well, we'll try to keep it upbeat and not delve too much into the tragedy, you know, but we will talk about it. But,
yeah, for sure. I think that'll be a really interesting one. Okay, so you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vicky, the guest sitting right next to me, Smith.
Well, you can find me at Reportin, that's REPORTON, N as in nanites.
Now, Vicky, you're not on Twitter, are you?
You can't find me.
But we're going to try anyways.
Okay.
So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.